Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Club Soderbergh, the podcast that reviews Soderbergh films from a female point of view. If you are joining us again, we're so happy to see you. And if it's your first time, well then, hello new friends. My name is Jessie Scott and I'm a video artist, programmer, producer and teacher. Jill of all trades, mistress of a few. I'm joined by creator of Club Soderbergh and eminent podcastrix, Carla Donnelly.
Hello.
And Maggie Scott, my very own sister and fellow polymath.
Hi.
Today we're going to kick off the real protein and starch of this podcast. The chronological assessment of a career spanning decades, formats, distribution models and countless B-grade celebrity career revivals. Last week we picked over the ample bones of Sex, Lies and Videotape, Soderbergh's debut feature, and this week we're going to move on to Kafka and King of the Hill, his all-important and emblematically eclectic second and third films. Maggie, would you like to introduce our first film for discussion, Kafka?
I understand you fancy yourself as a writer.
In a small way.
You should find a more athletic hobby. Put some colour in your cheeks.
Okay, so Kafka is Soderbergh's second film, and it's a thriller biopic fantasy, for want of a better genre. Based on Franz Kafka, who wrote in Prague at the turn of the 20th century. In the film, Kafka works at an insurance company by day writing reports, and at night he writes fiction, which is published in magazines nobody reads. His acquaintance at the company disappears, and he begins a personal investigation into where he's gone and what happened to him, because everything's just a bit off about it. Kafka's investigation ultimately leads him to the mysterious castle which rules the town and where all roads, actual, bureaucratic and metaphorical, seem to lead. Soderbergh started working on the script for Kafka in 1985, which was prior to the making of Sex, Lies and Videotape. Lem Dobbs was the script writer, and he was legendary in the film business already. He's known for his screenplay Edward Ford, which to this day has not been produced and made, but is revered in Hollywood circles for its brilliance. Dobbs' father was R.B. Kataj, an influential American Jewish artist of Russian-Hungarian descent, who had a great interest in Kafka. And this is interesting because Dobbs inherited this fascination about Kafka from his dad, and the father-son tension is very significant in Kafka's life and work. The common thread between Kafka, Dobbs in turn, and Soderbergh is that detached, baffled protagonist who is at odds with the world around him. But Soderbergh edited out all the family and romance stuff out of the script. He wanted to make it more of a thriller, and he wanted to make it more of a nod to The Third Man and Hitchcock's films before the 30s. And Dobbs was really pissed off. He thought that his script and the film in turn was mangled. So it all worked out. Lem and Steve went on to work together, as we will see in the future. The film was made for $11 million US. It was released in late 1991 and it didn't do well. Overall, it grossed just over $1 million. But now it has cult status, and especially among film buffs. So Soda Bangs. Is that an acceptable name for us?
Okay.
criticism at the time of release was that Kafka wasn't well portrayed in this film. And
interesting.
Pardon?
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And my question, I guess, is that I myself don't have much of a sense of Kafka. I never read his stuff. I do have an idea of the Kafkaesque, you know, the sort of maze-like, bureaucratic, impenetrable kind of system or building, like RMIT, for example. So I was just wondering if either of you guys have any knowledge of Kafka and an opinion as to whether Soderbergh did him justice in this film as a character.
I wouldn't say that I'm massively knowledgeable of Kafka's work, but Metamorphosis was one of my favourite books when I was younger, and I have seen The Trial as a play. But I actually thought if you kind of abandon the idea of this being a biopic, which it's not at all.
Yeah.
I think it's a great film, and I think it's very true to the spirit of, you know, the kind of what Kafka was trying to express in his novels.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I've read a lot of Kafka. I did see The Trial as well as a play, which I loved. And I don't think that it can be taken as a biopic, as Jess said. I think it is true to his vision of the world, of his sort of paranoia. I mean, I can't even say that it's paranoia, because I do believe that a lot of the, particularly like in something like The Trial, where, you know, this faceless bureaucracy decides whether you're guilty or not of a crime that you have or have not committed. I think it is a very excellent distillation of Crime and Punishment and the way that, you know, we put people on trial. But I particularly like it that he has sort of made it as a horror film, like, and really like a schlock horror film. Mm. And I've written quite a lot of notes here in terms of, like, I was trying to just really work out, it's a genre film, which I love. Like, he's gone from being this sort of very micro, you know, blunt film, very low key, to this huge genre pick with lavish sets and lots of outdoor scenes with people in period costume. And, you know, he obviously spent his money well and enjoyed spending the money. But, you know, I've got sort of like black and white Dadaist feel. Like, it totally really felt like a Dadaist movie, and I just sort of expected, you know, maybe Dali to kind of like creep around a corner. Or it was, people, you know, say that it was supposed to be more like a Bela Lugosi kind of pre-1930s horror film, but I really felt this Dadaist, you know, genre to it.
Yeah, and the aesthetic, while it does reference kind of noir and The Third Man, I definitely got that reference. I think there's also, you know, a reference to early 20th century photography, people like Alfred Stieglitz and André Curtez, who were really responding to the same things that Kafka was responding to, was this kind of new modernist society and, you know, the individual, you know, starkly contrasted with all this architecture and, you know, superstructures and, you know, the idea of being alienated in the modern city. So I think that it's totally perfect that he's chosen that aesthetic to pay homage to Kafka. Like, I think it works really well. What did you think, Maggie?
The movie reminded me a lot of Wings of Desire in some ways. Not in spirit. Like, it's got a very different, like, it's not as romantic as that film, but in the, like, the location of Prague, you know, because Wings of Desire is very much a homage to Berlin. There were moments when I was watching it where I was like, oh, that's so beautiful. I'd love to be there in black and white and walking around in, you know, beautiful clothes and feeling all kind of anarchic, anarchic.
It was gorgeous. It's a gorgeous film. It's a gorgeous film.
Beautiful, yeah. But the references I don't quite get, because I don't understand that period very well. It's not sort of an area of literature and art that I've explored that much, or if I have, I don't remember.
It didn't make an impression on you in any event.
Year 11 art didn't, you know, retain in your memory.
Year 12 art. Yeah. It hasn't stayed with me.
What about the humour? Because I thought it also kind of tapped into Kafka's humour, because even though, you know, we're talking about all this serious, you know, arty stuff, like, actually there's a lot of absurdity in his novels and in the movie. I thought it was quite funny. Especially towards the end, I was like, this is hilarious.
Yeah.
But I also found, like, I found its tone to be really all over the place, and literally as well with the camera tracking. Like, I felt like it was like a concert being shot, like that dolly and everything. Like, I was nauseated through most of the
really?
Film.
Okay.
It was busy. I found this film really busy. There was a lot of ideas, a lot of set dressings, a lot of background actors, a lot of costumes, a lot of dialogue. Mm-hmm. But the script in particular was the thing that really stuck out for me. Like, the dialogue, especially the dialogue of the gravedigger, or what do you even call, what are they called, cemeterian? I don't know. But his dialogue was beautiful. Like, it was really kind of this like, you'd imagine that he was sort of like a Slavic gypsy kind of rolling around with this beautiful poetry in his heart, you know, and saying all these fabulous things. So it felt really ambitious, and it felt really kind of excited, but it didn't have enough rein in for me for it to be entirely
a perfect
successful
movie. Like, I agree, it just didn't feel like I was very engaged by it, and, you know, but there were things that I loved and things that I found really bad. Like, I loved the scenes with the creepy leper screeching leopard. Like yeah. I got, yeah, I know, that was, and they actually creeped me out, but yeah. I thought they were funny at the same time.
Yeah, but that was very really Tom Browning's the freaks.
Yeah, know? Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I hated the twins. The Tweedledum.
Yeah, that slapstick yeah. didn't work.
It didn't work. It didn't work. It was tone deaf. And the tone was off.
Yeah.
What did you, I was curious to think, like, because I only picked up on it, you know, consciously, like, halfway through the film, but, like, how pretty much all the actors had different accents. Like, there was, like, European people and American people and English
then
people.
And Jeremy Irons, which is very...
And very, like, yeah. toffee English accents.
He was wonderful. It didn't bother me. Oh, my God, he's gorgeous. I thought it was sort of, you know, part of the whole magic realist kind of, you know, weird dreamscape of the film. I agree with you both that it's not quite successful, but I'm also... You know, and I felt quite confused and a bit vague through the first three quarters of it. But then at the end, with the brain and the huge microscope,
yeah.
I was like, I'm in. Yeah. I'm in. I'm in for this. Like,
and that kind
I
of reminded me
shock.
Of Altered States a little bit.
Yeah,
like
totally.
That, you know, and also the change of, like, entry into a colour.
Yeah.
A world of colour, which I thought
was it was a
awesome.
Hot mess, but I thought it was great.
Like, it was a hot mess, yeah.
But it's, you know, like, it's such good hot mess.
Yeah.
Like, I have
it was
to
compelling.
Say. Which, watching these two films, I'm like, Soderbergh was just on his game, even with a movie that didn't do that well. Like, it was still engaging and beautiful and so much better than, you know, your average crappy fare.
And like you said, Carla, ambitious, you know, like you just have to applaud the ambition and the chutzpah of him coming out after Sex, Lies and Videotape and being like, no, I'm going to make an obscure film about Kafka in black and white. And, you know, what? That's his whole attitude is so funny.
I also
like,
kind of,
you guys.
Yeah.
I also kind of felt like, I don't know, like, whether I'm projecting, but if that was me, I'd be like, well, fuck it. I'm going balls to the wall. Like, I may not ever get a budget this big again, so I'm going to make the passion project that I have. And it is going to be a bit messy because it doesn't really have... And I feel like he's starting to get his collaborators in place as well. Like, you know, and put two period pieces back-to-back as well as his second and third films I found really super interesting. And they're both very different period pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say I'm... having nightmares about Cliff Martinez since.
We've
had three films back-to-back with Cliff Martinez. And it will continue, as we all know, down the line. But those Siths were really starting to drive me crazy. But I did love the score for Kafka. I thought it was, like, really apt. But I didn't like the score for King of the Hill. What did you guys think about Cliff's score?
Yeah, the score for Kafka was with the, what was it, the cimbrom?
I don't know what that is. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, it's like a Hungarian kind of harpsichord on a table.
Oh, that is cool.
That you bang with a hammer. so that was, I thought that was interesting. It was a little bit jarring sometimes, but I liked it.
It was a little bit loud in places, but so was everything else. Like, that's what I mean about the tone.
I thought it was really appropriate, and it didn't. There was no point at which I felt it was, where it's overbearing, you know, whereas I felt in King of the Hill, I was like, ugh, so overbearing. I'm being directed here as to how to feel all the time. And I find that really irritating with soundtracks.
And just also genre inappropriate. Mm. Like I'm a bit of a stickler in that way. Like I don't want modern music or modern instruments in a period piece.
Mm.
Like it really takes me out of what we're supposed to be, you know, immersed in.
Mm.
I think also, like, in terms of women, we need to talk about his characterization of women, particularly going forward. But even though men centralize in most of his films, particularly in the beginning, the women in his films are always very interesting and fully realized characters. And the character of Gabriella, the the lady of his liking.
The rebel leader.
The rebel leader was completely fabulous. And I love that she was a brashy American. I don't know whether that was purposeful or he had a sort of subtle understanding of how Europeans view Americans. Yeah, but I really loved her as well.
I loved the fact that the anarchists were just so sexy and cool.
Yes.
And
in
real life, your local anarchist and socialist branch are not. they're not that.
No. They're more like the gimps.
Hello to all our anarchist listeners.
Yes.
I thought she was great too. I loved her kind of slinking around the office, just like brushing off the boss. And, you know, I thought it was really, Yeah. It made me think of all of the kind of bands of anarchists that have been depicted in film as well, like in Life of Brian. And there's a Spanish film, actually. I think it's called, I'm not going to remember it, but it's about the Spanish resistance movement in the 70s, and it's like the hottest anarchist you've ever seen in your life, like the hottest, coolest anarchist ever.
Mm-hmm. Left-wing politics looks sexy.
I really liked as well the character of Kafka, even though it wasn't autobiographically correct, according to Kafka S. Kafkarus. I'm really pissed off about it.
Kafkarus. It's awkward.
I just like that, you know, the whole idea of the writer trying to get to the bottom of the truth, and he's quite detached as a person but completely obsessed with finding, you know, out what's going on. I think that's kind of what the movie was about, just trying to get to the bottom of it. And then at the end, he's like, he's found the truth.
He's like, oh, well.
And it's completely fucked up. And he wants to unknow the truth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
You can tell, like, there's that, you know, that feeling of, like, I don't want to know about this.
She did die of suicide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also,
sorry, go.
I was just going to say, like, at the end, he writes a letter to his father. And throughout the movie, there's that reference, those references to his dad, like he doesn't want to have anything to do with his family. And then at the end, he's like, oh my God, I better really sort of get to know my dad.
Yeah.
For real, because, you know,
I also found the complete derision of arts as a practice in this film to be hilarious. You know, like his boss was like, you know, you're like, you need to get a different hobby you're really boring and no one wants to read what you write and
you've got to put some colour in your chair.
That was so funny. I loved all the kind of the self-referential stuff. Like that comment about got to put some colour in your cheeks. It's just like a really cheap joke about black and, you know, being black and white. And there were a few other moments like that in the film where it sort of, you know, I think Soderbergh can't help himself. Like, he doesn't really want to be taken too seriously, and there's sort of, constant little bits of humour like that throughout
it. But at the same time, he's such a...
He's making a film about Kafka.
He's such an artist, you know, like he can't help himself. Yeah. He's got to, try everything.
I also thought Jeremy Irons was fantastic. Like, I've never actually seen him give a performance like this. I think he's so kind of soft and vulnerable and kind of unsure of himself, and normally in films, you know, even just physically, he looks so much harder and sharper and, you know, he's more stern.
Yeah.
Whereas this was like a completely different character, and I thought he was amazing.
Yeah.
And that was so physical. Mm. Like, it was, I think, pretty much the most physical role I've ever seen Jeremy Irons in as well. I loved it. I did find it a bit too Brazil at the end, and that kind of like ruined it for me, particularly because like Brazil would have only been out for like 5 years by the time he made that film. But the production design in this is so strong and his eye is so strong. And I think this is what really endears me to him as a person and an artist. It's like, it's such an art wank to be like, I'm going to make a black and white film about Kafka set in Prague with all these like crazy accented people, about the torment of the artist, but also at the same time about like bureaucracy and conspiracy theories and stuff like that. But it's like really funny and kind of dumb and self-referential. And he's like, yes, I'm aware I'm making this film, but it's not kind of like in your face as well. So I loved it.
Like, I was in my reading about this movie, he was talking about Jeremy Irons and just saying what a great actor he is and so great to work with as well. But he made a comment about American actors versus British actors, or any other actor, any actor from any other part of the world can switch on and off. Like, they, when they're acting, they're acting. When they're not acting, they're just in the corner doing a crossword or whatever. But American actors, on the other hand, are like in character, you know, dragging everyone along with them. They can't just, you know, go home and have a cup of tea. And Soderbergh was laughing about that. It's a bit much, which I like. You know, he's down to earth in that way.
So if we're all ready, I think we should maybe move along to King of the Hill.
Listen to me, Aaron. You're going to be okay. You're a smart boy. You're very smart. I tell you how smart you are. Once when you were less than a year old, your mother was in a sanitarium with consumption, and you would cry every night. So the first few times I picked you up and you stopped crying, so I realized you just wanted attention. So the next time you cried, I got a glass of cold water, and I stood over the crib and I said, you see this? This is a glass of cold water, so you better stop crying or you'll be sorry. But you kept crying, so I poured the cold water in your face and you stopped crying just like that.
And from then on, when you cried, all I had to do was to show you the glass of water and you'd stop crying. Now that's a smart baby for you, eh?
So King of the Hill comes in 1993, 2 years after the, let's say, failing up of Kafka. It's a total shift in tone and style again from the first two films. This time, it's a fairly straight down the line, Hollywood-style coming-of-age story set in the Depression. Based on the autobiographical novel by the writer A.E. Hotchner and adapted by Soderbergh himself, it's set in sunny St. Louis, and King of the Hill follows Aaron, played by Jesse Bradford, who's about 14 years old, or 13, 14 years old, as he tries to survive on pretty much his wits alone through a series of escalating misfortunes against the backdrop of economic and social precarity of 1930s America. Aaron lives in a seedy motel with his loving but poorly mother, played by Lisa Eichhorn, his German immigrant travelling salesman father, who's Jeroen Krab, who was in Kafka as well. He was the cemetery guy, the sort of friend who he meets at the bar and stuff. So, yeah, same bit of a Soderbergh regular, who isn't shifting many units of his candles with no wicks, amazingly. And his cheeky younger brother who gets sent away to live with an uncle in the Midwest so the family can save money and get back on their feet. And they're kind of living for their father's promise that one day they'll move into this nice apartment block and out of the single hotel room they've all been sharing. Soon his mother is sent to a sanatorium, I don't know exactly what the word is, for rest and recovery from tuberculosis. And Aaron is left alone with his slightly manic down on his luck dad, who also then absconds shortly after, chasing his luck to Kansas as a watch salesman and leaving Aaron to his own devices without food or money. Somehow Aaron manages to graduate from high school throughout this, avoids getting kicked out of the hotel, and lives off a diet solely comprised of bread rolls, supplemented by the scraps left over on other kids' lunch trays at school. His closest friends and protectors in the hotel one by one also depart, one dramatically committing suicide, another dragged away by the cops. In one memorable scene, alone and locked in his hotel room, hallucinating from hunger, he cuts up pictures of food from a magazine and acts out eating them with a knife and fork. As the movie enters its third act, there's a real sense that he's scraping dangerously close to utter destitution. And perhaps we can leave the discussion of the ending for our discussion together. King of the Hill was generally very well received critically at the time, if not the box office kind of smash hit par Sex, Lies and Videotape. And it's still cited as an example of Soderbergh's talent for writing. But I have to admit, I found the movie a little bit dull. or bland.
Me too. I didn't.
You didn't?
No.
Despite the potentially dramatic content. So, what did you guys think? I wonder where you both see this fitting into the Soderbergh oeuvre. Given his first two efforts, why do you think he made this film so completely different again when he made it?
I think in the context of having read a bit forward, like to The Underneath and Schizopolis. I think he's getting a little bit ground down by this point by the Hollywood system.
Right.
And he's challenging himself as usual, like with, you know, sets and costume and all of those things.
Working with children.
Yeah. Yes, he did that on
purpose. That's an entirely new thing, yeah.
Yeah. So I think he's definitely challenging himself, trying to, you know, get his chops as a director. But I think as well, there's a lot of things getting in the way and, you know, he has to negotiate and compromise and all that sort of stuff. So maybe that explains the kind of the tone.
It definitely felt like a compromise to me. Like, there just wasn't a passion there. I don't know. Like, it was very well written, very well made, as we can expect from, you know, our director. Mm. But it was, yeah, bland is a very good word. Like, it didn't have a very, like, yeah, you know, like, of course listeners would be like, oh, but there was a starving child. Like, that's dramatic art. But how do you even make that boring? Like, you know, lots of, you know, fabulous bit parts. You know, I think that there was, like, just so much more opportunity for drama and characterization with all of the characters that lived on the third floor of this hotel, seemingly, like, you know, rummies and bad types and all that kind of thing, but it didn't really kind of get there.
Yeah, I kind of felt as though it was a little bit too clean. Like, this was shot on a soundstage, yeah. It did feel to me like it had the edges taken off. And considering the context that it was about the Depression era and so many bad things happened to this kid, I feel like there's only a couple of scenes where that really comes home to you. Like, and one of them is when he has some sort of straight shots of the sort of shanty town that's been set up on the main drag of people who've lost their accommodation, have lost their jobs, and they're living rough. And that felt very Soderberghian to me. That was the only part of the film that had that kind of texture of real life or kind of specificity. And, yeah, I just felt as though, even though the story is really interesting, it's this classic American tale. It's like, you know, Don Draper in Mad Men. It's that fatherless generation. It was all kind of undercut for me by these weird, you know, happy-go-lucky Huckleberry Finn, you know, a rough and tumble interludes that just felt really like, I think they could have been, they could have worked, but they were overdone.
Yeah.
They could have made the whole thing sort of more complex and nuanced. But for me, it was just like weird clash of tones that didn't, that kind of cancelled each other out.
Yeah.
But I kind of enjoyed that. Like I there were many moments where I could have just sort of drifted off and looked at my phone, but something always kept me watching. So yeah, I enjoy. I'm not saying it's my favourite Soderbergh film.
Sure.
I would never say that. That would be way too controversial.
We'll make you say it at the end of the production in a year's time.
King of the Hill is my favourite.
Everyone's going to have to say their favourite.
I already know what my favourite is.
Do you tell us what you like about it. Maybe that will help us jog our memories and be more kind.
I just like, I haven't thought hard enough about that. It just kept me going.
Warm and fuzzy
and just engaging enough to keep me going. Like, I think as well, it's still better than most other films I see.
Yeah, you know, there's something to be said for that. There's something to be said for just a good film that, like, doesn't ask too much of you.
Yeah, that's how I felt. It didn't ask too much. It was, you know, I think that character stuff, like, it wasn't so demanding that I had to be engaged or passionate about a character. I felt for that boy, like getting, you know, really hungry and left behind. He had so much potential, but at the same time, he's so beautiful.
Who was cutting his hair? Can someone please tell me how he managed to go through all of this and his hair didn't grow?
Yeah.
that bothered me. I was like, who was cutting his hair?
Maybe Adrian Brody?
Yeah.
But I was surprised when he said that I thought that the graduation ceremony was like some weird like primary school graduation. Like I had no concept that he was a teenager. Well, I thought he was like 11.
Yeah, no, I think he was a 12-year-old boy, Jess.
Okay, 12-year-old. Yeah. The actor was 14. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that makes a little bit more sense. But yeah, and even then, like, I still found like the sort of burgeoning romance between he and the epileptic girl next door like quite inappropriate. Mm. I don't know. But then also, I feel like it really kind of did try to convey like of the time of like, yeah, kids like worked or they didn't go to school or they didn't have parents or they you know, stole food and they were like fully functioning adults at the age of 12 because they had no other choice.
That's pretty interesting, the fact that his dad would just leave him there.
Yeah.
And at the end, you know, he shows up again and just sort of
papers over it,
you know, like, thank you for not carrying on about this, son.
He was an asshole. Can we talk about his dad? He was horrible.
But I think that this was a generation of children that had terrible fathers.
Tough love.
Yeah. Tough love, and also people who have, like, you know, escaped persecution and that kind of mania that can happen in the new world as well, of like when you have so many things, more things available to you that you did, you know, from where you've come from, like that real
opportunity
kind of,
that you have to really,
take. And also it's like an era of no contraception, because I'm like, you know, these poor women, like, why would you have children? And then I'm like, oh, because they like couldn't stop it.
Yeah.
You know.
The kind of message that I got from the film was about how in this era, in this period in American history, just how many people, you know, how many near misses, you know, that a lot of people had stories like this in their childhood, that a lot of people just survived and kept going and they were all right, you know. And I think that was like maybe the flaw of the film, is that actually we know they weren't all right. You know, like that scene at the end where they all arrive at the apartment together and, him and his dad have this moment where, you know, he sort of doesn't trust this man. He doesn't even know him. He's like, you just abandoned me. And that was really traumatic, but it's all unspoken. And his father's like, come on, just come and hug your mother. And he's like, okay. And I'm like, nah, that's not how it would have, you know, that's not the end of the story. The story goes on and he ends up in therapy.
Feels like it's the beginning of the cycle again.
Yeah.
Like, that's what that scene really felt like to me. Like, you know, they just skip out on their bills every 6 months and start again in a different place or a different hotel and maybe, like, getting... and who knows, like, you even begin to doubt whether, like, the job that he had gotten was real. Like, I wasn't even sure that that was happening.
Yeah.
But you do kind of get the impression that their luck does get better, a little bit better each time they go through this cycle. But,
Yeah, I just feel it was not well resolved.
We're
it
all
just
a bit underwhelmed by this one, aren't we?
Yeah, fully.
It's not really.
It felt resigned.
Yeah.
If I can say that. But it probably, you know, was a good technical aspect of shooting a film on a soundstage, of, you know, keeping a lot of stakeholders happy, churning out something that actually made more money, kind of getting his balance back to zero after everything else that happened. I could not find much information about this film at all.
People really liked it. I mean, there's really good reviews of it online. It's still really well regarded.
One thing I do want to say, actually, is that maybe our experience of it is gendered, because I have spoken about this film to a couple of men and they're like, oh, I really like that film. I loved it. Oh, I loved it when it came out. I saw it when I was a kid. You know, it really resonated with me.
I feel like I would like it if I was a kid, but I didn't find much to relate to in him as a main character.
I have to say, in the interview I read, Soderbergh said that one of his influences was My Life as a Dog.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I loved that film as a kid. And as a kid, I loved that film, and it was a film about a kid. I feel more passionate about My Life as a Dog than I do about this film. I definitely relate it, even though that was a male protagonist. I think it was a Swedish film.
You connected with it when you were a child yourself.
I did, yeah. But, yeah, I didn't have that same feel, you know. It was emotionally kind of detached, maybe.
Yeah.
And also, this is our first appearance of Spalding Gray in Steven Soderbergh's world.
So. Is he Mr. Munro?
Mr. Mungo. So he, I presume, is still obsessed with Spalding Gray. I don't know. Spalding Gray died in the 90s. And later on, he makes a documentary about Spalding Gray, which we won't cover because it's a doco, which is a good thing because I don't particularly share the enthusiasm for him.
I could somewhat guess that from how you were describing this.
But I find his entrance really interesting, and the sort of psychology of his leading men, even though the child was obviously the leading man, quote unquote. We've had three films now, and all of the leading men have been these, you know, not traditionally handsome, well, not traditionally good looking, but very handsome, manly men, but not macho. I really sort of like this progression of projection from him as well, because as we'll see going down the line, like the act, particularly the actors, but then also the women that he becomes obsessed with in casting as well, is just so fascinating and also like really a part of his psychology and what I like about his films.
His casting is super interesting.
It's so good.
I think.
It's amazing.
It's very unexpected at times, but really effective, the sort of people that he gets.
Have you read anything about his philosophy of casting? Or
he gets really good casting directors. He puts a lot of time into it. I mean, he's obsessed.
In this film, Jesse Bradford was the first kid that he met.
Yeah.
And he said, this is the one.
Yeah.
And the casting director was like, we can't choose the first one that you interview. But he ended up kind of persisting with him. Yeah.
Oh, I do have one note that I wrote down for this film. Or was it for Kafka? Was Stuart Kornfeld the producer on this film? I think he was. So Stuart Kornfeld is someone who he will maintain a relationship with for the rest of his career. But I've read something really funny about it. Say that, have you guys seen Tropic Thunder? So Tom Cruise's character in Tropic Thunder, Les Grossman, is supposedly based on this guy Stuart Cornfield, who's the so to me, like, the most interesting about this film is, like, imagining these two tootling around on set together making this film.
Les Grossman.
I don't really have anything else to say about this.
No,
film.
I don't either.
All right, we'll cut it off short.
Yeah. So it's now time to press pause.
Press pause. Press pause.
So everyone should actually like our Facebook page, because we're starting to build a repository of these types of information. But being the obsessive workaholic that he is going to recut Kafka. And he shot a whole bunch of new scenes for Kafka while he was making side effects.
Really?
So he's going to make a Blu-ray version, which will be the original version of Kafka. And now there's new, he's like, I want to make a proper art movie. And I'm just what is that going to be? So he's going to recut it. He's going to dub it in German to get rid of the accent.
Oh, that'll be weird.
It'll be amazing. It's going to be so amazing.
Even weirder.
Even weirder. So he's going to recut it, insert these new scenes. He didn't like the narrative structure, so he's going to change that, and he's going to overdub it in German. So this interview was in 2013, so who knows when it's going to come out, but it's, you know, obviously on the back burner of projects that he's got going on. So that's my great. Biggest piece of goss that I found out.
Yeah. That is exciting.
Exciting.
I'd love to see that. I think it would be really good to see how he reinterprets it.
Yeah, so he's calling it an After Dark version. So it's you watch the normal one, and then later at night you watch the recut, scarier audio version.
I hope he still has that screaming, screeching leper. I'll be very happy.
It's great. So good.
What about you guys? Any points of interest?
Well, I mean, it's debatable whether this is a point of interest, but A.E. Hotchner, who was the author of the original King of the Hill, was actually the neighbour of one Paul Newman, and in fact was his business partner in Paul Newman's own tomato sauce. Oh.
Just the tomato sauce, none of the rest of the brand?
No, they also ran a children's charity together, but that's all I got, because I didn't know either of these films before.
Oh, that's funny, because you made the tomato sauce soup in the movie.
Oh, my God, it's all, yes. Okay,
yeah. Yes. It's all coming together, guys. Yeah.
Have you guys seen these films before?
No, not at all.
Never.
Oh, look, I have a vague memory of King of the Hill, but I don't know whether I saw an ad for it as a trailer on another movie, or whether I'd actually seen it at some point. I didn't have a very, I got to the scene where he was eating the food, the pictures of the food, and I was like, oh, that's familiar. I think I've seen that before. Yeah.
Well, I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole with Lem Dobbs, who's the script writer for Kafka, and who Soderbergh will work with, as we see, as we go on. And he's quite an interesting guy in himself. And he really hated Kafka, really hated it. And I think he got up on his high horse a day after Jeremy Irons had been interviewed and said that the script was a bit of a crap script or something. Whoa. And that the actors had to change some of the dialogue to make it better. And so then he was interviewed the next day, and he just was like, this is crap, this film. It mangulated it.
Double-barreled.
And so Soderbergh had to kind of repair that relationship, because he really likes Lem Dobbs. And Lem Dobbs is actually quite a legend in Hollywood for various reasons. He was really good friends with Billy Wilder. When he was a child, he was in Powell and Pressburger's last film together. So he's got all these different connections, in new and old Hollywood. And, I think Soderbergh really wanted to hold on to that.
He seemed to make a few pretty public gaffes in his early career, didn't he? He made some comments about some producers, some quite big producers after Sex, Lies and Videotape, saying they were basically slime.
It's probably true.
Well, yes.
But you don't say that
to the press. When you're a 25-year-old first-time filmmaker.
Maybe that's why we see his independent career start very soon in the next couple of episodes. Mm.
And that concludes episode 2 of Club Soderbergh. For those of you playing along at home, next month we'll be looking at The Underneath and Schizopolis. And if you haven't caught up on our first episode yet, there's still time. Check out episode 1, Sex Lies Videotape, wherever you get good podcasts. We'd also like to take a moment to thank a few people. Credit must be given to friend of the podcast, Andrew Junor, for coming up with the name Club Soderbergh. Yuck, yuck, yuck. Thanks, Angie. And most of all to Zeph Anastasio, who has generously donated his exceptional skills to record and produce us. We appreciate your time and efforts. We'd love to hear from you, hear about your memories of Soderbergh films, or your favourite bits of Soderbergh trivia. You can contact the team at Club Soderbergh?
I know, it's, yeah, Club at Club Soderbergh.
Club at Club Soderbergh.
really inventive there.
.com. Or the same, the Facebook page Club Soderbergh, or the same for Twitter, Club Soderbergh. We'd really love to be engaged with other Soderbergh tragics, so please don't be shy. See you in a month.